Today is Friday, December 13th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Steve Miller in Washington. Coming up, Boris Johnson and his Conservative Party won Britain's election on Thursday.
Good morning, everybody, my friends. Well, we did it. We did it. We pulled it off, didn't we? We pulled it off. We broke the deadlock. We ended the gridlock. We smashed the roadblock.
Now we take a closer look at the results and the impact on Johnson's victory may have on Brexit and the economy. And now Republicans and Democrats have moved forward the articles of impeachment against President Trump. So what's next? British Prime Minister Boris Johnson's Conservative Party has secured a majority of the 650 seats in the House of Commons. Thursday's election handed Johnson his first national victory, but also delivered a dramatic blow to his main competitor, opposition leader Jeremy Corbyn, whose Labour Party suffered heavy losses as the largest Conservative majority since the 1980s, and Johnson says voters have proven they want to get Brexit done.
This election means that getting Brexit done is now the irrefutable, irresistible, unarguable decision of the British people. And with this election, I think we put an end to all those miserable threats of a second referendum.
John McDonnell is the Labour shadow chancellor, and he says that despite his party's efforts to make the election about other issues, this time the vote appears to have really been about, as Johnson was saying, to get Brexit done.
Brexit dominated the whole debate. We couldn't break through on other issues, so I think it was Brexit. If you look at what's happened in most of the seats, particularly in the northern seats, the vote shift has been from Labour to the Brexit party around the Tories. So, I think we just couldn't get through the Brexit argument, basically.
And what about Mr. Corbyn's leadership? Did that play a role?
And Mr. Corbyn has said that he will not lead the party into the next election. But joining us on the phone to break down the election results from London is Henry Ridgewell. Henry, welcome to the program.
Good to be with you, Steve.
So, Henry, we spoke on Wednesday prior to the election, and we heard you tell us that the polls were showing that there was a shrinking majority looking forward to vote for the Conservative Party. They really turned out in force for Boris Johnson and the party.
It did, and I guess it just shows how difficult it is for the pollsters to predict the results these days when there are so many different factors in play and such a dynamic with the electorate. The old certainties of working class voting for Labour and the ruling classes, if you like, voting for Conservative have gone, and that's made it very difficult to predict. And even the Conservative Party were surprised by the scale of their victory last night. The final results have come in the last couple of hours, giving them a majority of 80 seats. The Labour Party's vote was down around 8%. And you heard John McDonnell there, the shadow chancellor, saying that it was all about Brexit and they couldn't break through. And some people agree with that point of view, but the inquest has begun among the opposition Labour Party as to exactly what did go wrong, and not everyone agrees. Some say it wasn't down to Brexit, it was all down to one man himself, Jeremy Corbyn, the leader, who was the biggest problem on the doorstep. And there's one poll out today that has actually asked those voters why they did not vote for the Labour Party. By far the majority say it was because of Jeremy Corbyn. Only around 17% said it was because of Brexit.
Now, you highlighted the really landslide victory that has been handed the Conservative Party. You know, going into this, the Conservatives were really having a hard time getting the Brexit deal passed through the House of Commons. This is expectedly going to sail through. You know, as you mentioned, this was largely about Brexit in terms of what people were saying, according to the Conservative Party. What are the next steps in terms of the House of Commons in terms of moving the deal forward?
We're expecting, well, already Boris Johnson has been invited to form the new government, and we're expecting the Parliament to resume next week and to try to get the initial stages of that withdrawal agreement passed. And then I think we're going to have a pause for Christmas and the New Year break, and then when Parliament reconvenes in January, that's when most of the business will get done of passing the withdrawal agreement and also all the domestic legislation that goes with it in time for the January 31st deadline, which both London and Brussels now very much have in mind. And as you say, those roadblocks in Parliament, remember it wasn't just the opposition MPs that were blocking the Brexit deal, it was many of the Conservative Party MPs as well. They've all been swept aside. A lot of those difficult names that were blocking the legislation have gone, and all of the new Conservative Party MPs have signed up, in theory, to Boris Johnson's Brexit deal. They say they're ready to go for it. So after 3.5 years of difficulties, of argument, of the possibility of another referendum, of revoking, I think today is a landmark day in British political history. I think we can safely say Britain is going to go ahead with Brexit now on the 31st of January, and we move on to what the second stage might be and Britain's future relationship.
Henry Ridgewell reports out of London. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Great to be with you.
The House of Representatives Judiciary Committee passed 2 articles of impeachment against U.S. President Donald Trump a day after a divisive 14-hour debate, largely along party lines. Democratic Chair Jared Nadler opened today's session.
Because the resolution contains 2 distinct propositions, we will divide the question between the 2 articles. The question now is on Article 1 of the resolution, impeaching President Donald J. Trump for abusing his powers. The clerk will call the roll.
The vote was strictly along the party lines, with all 23 Democrats voting in favor of both articles of impeachment and all 17 Republicans voting against it.
Without objection, the committee is adjourned.
The measure is now being sent to the full House of Representatives next week for a floor vote, which could happen as early as Wednesday. Mr. Trump is accused in the first article of abusing his presidential power by asking Ukraine to investigate his 2020 election rival, former Vice President Joe Biden, while holding military aid as leverage, and in the second article of impeachment, of obstructing Congress by blocking the House's efforts to probe his actions. The White House has called the process a sham and said it was looking forward to the Senate trial. VOA national correspondent Jim Malone has more on what that trial may look like.
Senate will come to order.
In the Senate, a call for divine guidance from Chaplain Barry Black.
Lord, guide our senators to the right paths. Lead them beside still waters. Restore their souls.
The Senate has been down this road before. In 1999, President Bill Clinton was acquitted of perjury and obstruction of justice related to his affair with intern Monica Lewinsky. In 1868, President Andrew Johnson survived a Senate trial by a single vote after he was impeached for violating a congressional act protecting high government officials from removal.
There was absolutely nothing done wrong.
In the case of President Trump, House Democrats have accused him of abuse of power and obstruction of Congress by allegedly pressuring Ukraine to investigate a political rival, Democrat Joe Biden. Congressman Jerry Nadler chairs the House Judiciary Committee.
Our president holds the ultimate public trust. When he betrays that trust and puts himself before a country, he endangers the Constitution, he endangers our democracy, and he endangers our national security.
Trump has denied the allegations and is counting on Senate Republicans to vote to acquit him in an impeachment trial.
The radical left Democrats and the failed Washington establishment are trying to erase your votes, nullify the election, and overthrow our democracy. It's not going to happen. Don't worry about it. I wouldn't lose too much sleep over it.
Congressional Republicans have remained loyal to Trump, with only a few senators voicing criticism so far, says Julie Pace.
It doesn't mean that they will vote to convict him, but it does mean that we may see a scenario in which you have at least some members of Trump's party expressing real concern about his interactions with Ukraine.
To remove the president from office, 2/3 of the Senate, 67 out of the 100 senators would have to vote to convict Trump on one or more articles of impeachment. That's very unlikely, says Larry Sabato.
I don't see how in the world you could ever get 20 Republican senators to vote to oust Donald Trump. They might as well vote to oust and then announce their resignations, because they won't be serving for very long once they cast that vote.
No matter the outcome, a Senate impeachment trial will be a demanding test for U.S. democracy, says Democrat Mark Warner.
And I would hope and pray that all of my Senate colleagues will take a deep breath, and no matter kind of where we've been so far, and step back and realize this is probably the most important constitutional responsibility we have.
Even if Trump survives a Senate trial, his actions on Ukraine will likely be a top issue in the 2020 presidential campaign. Jim Malone, VOA News, Washington.
Friday has seen a lot of economic news, first with the successful election of Boris Johnson's Conservative Party in the United Kingdom. Brexit looks like it will take place on January 31st of 2020. And prior to going to air today, U.S. President Donald Trump and Chinese respective authorities announced they have tentatively reached a phase one trade deal. And I'll break everything down. We're joined on the phone from the Peterson Institute for International Economics. Sherman Robinson, thank you for joining us today.
Delighted to be here.
So let's start with Brexit. We now have a very huge majority in the House of Commons. Looks like it will pass the measures there to get Brexit done, as Boris Johnson said during the campaign. Now that this kind of uncertainty as to when or what Brexit may look like is passed, you know, we've seen an upsurge in the pound sterling already today, a 1.1% or so. What does that do in terms of the economic situation in Britain and Europe?
Well, he certainly won a major victory in the parliament, but he only got 44% of the voters, and that's because of Britain has this first-past-the-post system for parliamentary elections. If you add up all the voters for parties that were in favor of either stopping Brexit or wanted a second referendum, they got a majority of the vote. So public opinion is still deadlocked in Britain. He will put it through. He ran on that, and he's got a certain serious parliamentary majority to be able to do it. But he will also, one hopes, be constrained not to do a collapse Brexit where they have a crash out. So hopefully you'll have some kind of a Brexit deal, which will not be as devastating to the British economy. It'll be bad for the economy. All the economic studies that have been done to date indicate pretty much overwhelmingly that Brexit is not good for Britain. But it should be a much smoother transition, one hopes.
Switching gears to the U.S. and China trade dispute, President Donald Trump announced that, you know, a tentative phase one deal has been inked where some of the tariffs placed on China will be reduced. There's word that this covers some intellectual property standpoint. I wanted to get your reaction now that we have this deal announced, even though it hasn't been signed yet.
Yeah, it's what he called a phase one deal. They're evidently discussing intellectual property issues, which the Chinese had already said they would be willing to open to do. Opening up some markets, which, again, the Chinese had expressed interest in that. They are going to do a dispute resolution process. It'll be very interesting to see how that works. They also are claiming a win on financial services and exchange rate policy. China has already agreed on the exchange rate policy, and they are no longer having been considered a currency manipulator for a long time. So it's not a big step for China, but it's only a rather small step in rolling back tariffs. All the tariffs that were in place as of last summer, 25% on $250 billion, another 7.5% on $120 billion, they're still in place. So this is not changing the protection much. They've just postponed or agreed not to put on the December tariffs and rolling back some of the tariffs of the late fall. It's not clear what the Chinese are going to do on their side. They may leave their tariff retaliation in place, since it was largely in response to the first round.
Thank you very much, Sherman. I really appreciate that. We're out of time. Sherman Robinson is with the Peterson Institute for International Economics, and you're listening to VOA News.
This is Science in a Minute.
An extensive new study brings troubling news for people who consume two or more soft drink servings a day. The study, which was coordinated by the International Agency for Research on Cancer, found people who drink two or more glasses of soda each day, compared to those who drink no more than one soft drink per month, had a higher risk of death from a wide range of causes. For those of you who think you're safe because you drink sugar-free beverages, sorry, but the research suggests it doesn't matter if you're drinking soft drinks sweetened with sugar or with artificial sweeteners. The mortality risks are the same. Specifically, the study authors found that drinking two or more glasses of artificially sweetened soft drinks per day was positively linked to deaths from cardiovascular disease, while consuming one or more glasses of sugar-sweetened soft drinks each day was positively associated with deaths from digestive diseases. I'm VOA's Rick Pantaleo.
VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Steve Miller. A military team recovered six bodies from the volcanic island that fatally erupted earlier this week in New Zealand. It was a high-risk operation watched by dozens. Reuters' Eve Johnson has this update.
New Zealand launched a risky operation on Friday. Recovery teams brought back six bodies from a volcanic island that erupted earlier this week. On the mainland, grieving family members waited, anxious for news. Authorities have faced growing pressure to recover the bodies as soon as possible, but police had refused to go due to safety risks. The conditions on Friday were potentially deadly. Experts warned the White Island volcano had a good chance of erupting again. The operation was carried out by a bomb disposal squad, but slowed down by heavy protective gear, they had to leave two bodies behind. Police Commissioner Mike Bush said they haven't given up yet.
We do believe that at least one of them is in the water, and the other one, we are unsure, so it only leaves two possibilities. One is still on the island, and we haven't located them, or they too are in the water.
Police have deployed dive teams in the waters around the island and plan another aerial search of the area later on Friday. The White Island volcano erupted on Monday, spewing ash, steam, and gases over the island. 47 visitors were on the island at the time. The official death toll stands at 8, but that's due to rise after the bodies are formally identified.
And that was Reuters reporter Eve Johnson. America's chief negotiator for peace in Afghanistan, Zalmay Khalilzad, visited Pakistan on Friday, a day after he briefly suspended peace talks with the Taliban in Qatar in retaliation for this week's attack by the insurgent group on the largest U.S. military base in Afghanistan. Earlier, I spoke with Ayaz Ghul in Islamabad for more.
For the last few days, both the U.S. And the Taliban negotiators were holding discussions, and what we were hearing about the process was that things were moving smoothly, and the discussions were focused on how to quickly conclude an agreement between the two sides. But then, as we know, on Wednesday, the Taliban launched a major attack on Bagram Air Base, which is the largest U.S.-run base in Afghanistan, although there were no casualties on part of the American forces or NATO allies in that attack, but civilians, Afghan civilians were hurt. So that apparently outraged the U.S. chief negotiator, Zalmay Khalilzad, and he protested just before the discussions broke off on Thursday. He informed the Taliban, this is not the way to go forward in terms of striking a peace deal. So he suspended the process.
What substantively do we know about what's going on in those discussions?
Well, what we know from the U.S. side is that when Zalmay Khalilzad went into this latest round of discussions, he clearly stated that he was going in to urge the Taliban to reduce violence or observe a ceasefire so that the two sides can conclude the agreement. But what we also know that after Khalilzad's statement before starting the negotiations last Saturday, The Taliban also came out with their statement that any step like observing a ceasefire or reducing violence or engaging in intra-Afghan negotiations was directly linked to the signing of the agreement between the U.S. and the Taliban on the withdrawal of all foreign forces from Afghanistan. So we know that even though the negotiations were restarted, the two sides clearly had differences on how to move further. So in the last 6 days, we know from the Taliban side, from the sources that I have spoken to in Doha, is that Zalmay Khalilzad and his team consistently called for a reduction of violence and a ceasefire, but the Taliban did not agree to it, and then in the meantime, this attack in Afghanistan happens. You know, it's very difficult to guess exactly what is being discussed, but when you look at the statements both sides have issued publicly, we know that the U.S. really wants the Taliban to announce a ceasefire, and the insurgent group believes that any such step would undermine its bargaining position in the dialogue process.
These discussions are taking on the heels of the Washington Post's treasure trove of information, commonly called the Afghan Papers. Has that affected anything in your neck of the woods in terms of how people are viewing the United States and their policies towards Afghanistan and the position of the U.S. negotiations in these discussions?
Well, let me tell you, those papers have really undermined the U.S. bargaining position in these negotiations, because now the Taliban, through their social media outlets, have been consistently making their point that they have been telling Afghans that they have, according to them, defeated the United States and its allies, and that they were not being told the truth. And now these papers have established the Taliban's position. So they are really taking advantage of these papers.
Ayaz Ghul is in Islamabad. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Thank you, Steve.
Now, the next Star Wars movie arrives in theaters next Thursday. For those looking at a calendar, that's December 19th. The movie promises an epic conclusion to three trilogies over four decades and answers to at least some of the biggest questions that have puzzled fans. From a galaxy far, far away, Reuters' Ryan Brooks reports.
The next Star Wars epic, The Rise of Skywalker, arrives in theaters on Thursday. But will the long-awaited conclusion to the Star Wars series be as epic as fans hope? Director J.J. Abrams seems pretty confident.
I guess I would describe the movie as the gamut of emotions that you feel, I would like to think, the sort of thrill of friends on a daring adventure, surprise because things don't go the way you expect, horror because I think things get pretty intense and scary.
The Star Wars franchise began in 1977 with George Lucas's movie about farm boy turned hero Luke Skywalker. But along the way, it's left some lingering questions, puzzling fans of the galaxy far, far away. The Rise of Skywalker is the ninth in the series. It's billed as an end to the story and promises some answers. Audiences will learn more about what drives helmeted villain Kylo Ren, as well as ex-stormtrooper Finn. Actor John Boyega explains.
We're going deep into his past and the mysteries of his history and what happened to him, why he decided to leave the First Order. And that comes through a really cool relationship in this.
The film also reveals new information about Rey's parents. Daisy Ridley plays the Resistance fighter.
There's a lot of joy. And the ending is emotional. That's not to say it's totally sad. It's definitely emotional. But I think people will be uplifted when they leave the cinema.
The film's creators have kept the plot under tight wraps, stirring speculation about how it all ends. Clips show Rey wielding a lightsaber glowing red, the color associated with the dark side, raising questions about whether she switches allegiances. But one major mystery likely will linger after the credits roll. Parent company Disney says it plans to hit pause on the franchise for a while, leading fans to wonder just when they'll be able to get their next Star Wars hit.
And that was Reuters reporter Ryan Brooks, and that's going to do it for us today. You've been listening to International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of our production staff here, thank you very much for joining us today. And until next time, I'm Steve Miller in Washington,
Have a great weekend.